you any good.
Right.
It wouldn't do you any
good.
However, I'll connect you with Vanity. You have Vanity stones.
Is that much better?
Yo, he's far. No, Dave's far.
You know this?
It's like hamsters on wheels running around alive.
All right, good evening. Well, we know this is Leviticus, correct?
I'm sure Jeremy used up all the Leviticus jokes last week. Someone asked me on Sunday why we're doing Leviticus as the only adult offering, you know, on Wednesday nights, the other, and it was because we wanted you to have a singing class. That was the idea.
No. I'm actually a big fan of Leviticus. It's easy to quit reading the Bible through in a year over this book. And it's easy to get bogged down and lose heart. But I actually think it's one of the greatest books in the Bible. But one of the things that makes it challenging is, you know, as much as usually in our Bible we want to be focused more on the details, and not be sloppy in our reading. This is a book where, for once, actually, the key is to not get bogged down in the details, focus on the big picture. It's the exact opposite with Leviticus. If you can focus on the details, you'll know how to dissect an animal in some pretty vivid ways, but you've lost sight, you'll miss big picture. And in big picture, this is one of the most important books in the Bible. And hopefully, by the end of the quarter, you'll feel that way too. So, my appreciation to Jeremy filling in last week. It is beyond cruel to ask somebody to start a class that's not theirs at the beginning of a quarter with you know, nothing laid down, no notes, no precedents established. And then to ask him to do it on Leviticus, even more so. But Jeremy is what we call a utility infielder in the congregation. And he's a good man who always says yes. And I appreciate him letting me abuse him like that. So let's begin with a word of prayer. Can the brother lead us in that? Thank you, Bill.
Let us bow, please. Holy Father, thank you for this day and for its many blessings. Thank you for this class tonight to revive our thinking about the kingdom and behave more in accord with your will. Thank you, Father, for Jeff and all the assembled here. We know we are blessed by your love. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
All right, since we're doing Leviticus, that means, of course, we go back to Exodus. I'm still recovering from where I was last week. Exodus 19. Three things we need to look at. Three quick passages in Exodus. Because believe it or not, if you actually, I've just got through saying don't look at the details in Leviticus, you'll get bogged down. If you do look at the detail of how the book begins kind of the middle of the story. It actually, despite it seem like it's a collection of legal stuff, ultimately, it still sits in the narrative context that's going on in the Pentateuch. That's easily lost. Give me 5 minutes here for all these lines to set us up for where we're at tonight. Exodus 19. Of course, Exodus 19, they've just come out of Egypt. They've made their journey to Sinai. God has told Moses that he is coming down on Sinai, and the people are to get ready. And, of course, the people, there's a number of things that the people are expected to do. I'm going to pick up in Exodus 19. I want to begin in verse 9. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud." Remember the cloud matters. Coming to you in a thick cloud. I've already lost my place. It's going to be a long night. That the people may hear when I speak with you, and may also believe you forever. Easily missed the detail, especially we just got through bashing details. The original plan was for God to speak to the entire people from Sinai, not for Moses to be the mediator, the in-between guy. When Moses told the words of the people to the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people, consecrate them." What's another word for consecrate?
Sanctify.
But all, you'll consecrate, sanctify, all go around what word?
Purify.
Holy. There it is. Holy. The key word of Leviticus. The key word of Leviticus is holiness. Okay? And so to get ready for God to come requires holiness. And so you've got, you know, I'm not here yet, I'm coming. And you've got to get ready for my coming. And so go to the people and consecrate them today, tomorrow. Let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. You have 3 days to get ready. Wash their clothes. From the third day, the Lord will come down out Mount Sinai in the sight of all the people. And you shall set ESV says limits. What's your translation say?
Bounds.
Yeah.
Bounds. And the fuller word of that we sometimes use?
Boundary.
Boundaries. Boundaries. Limits. You're going to set boundaries. You're going to set limits. And then you're to say, verse 12, take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. In other words, you transgress or you cross the boundary, what happens to you?
Yeah.
Death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot, whether beast or man, even the animals. He shall not live. Why? Okay, so if you're to put him to death, why do you think you can't touch him? Whether it's man or animal who touches the mountain, why can't you touch him?
Yeah, we're not purified. It's God is purified.
Yep, very much so. Works this way. It works this way. The most foundational categories is basically, first of all, holy, unholy. Which are a function ultimately of sin, and we'll just call it no sin, which works itself out practically in clean and unclean, all of which revolve around life and death. And one of the things that Leviticus is going to teach us is that one of these things, one side, and basically you draw a line all the way through each of these kind of records. Well, I bet you put no sin.
Never seen sin.
Fix that. Just realize, okay. Anyways, and you can draw lines all the way down and all the way down. You with me? Make sense? One side of this little dichotomy is contagious. One side is not. Which side is contagious? Which side spreads?
Right side.
My right or your right?
Yes.
All right. This side. It's contagious, right? If an unclean thing touches something else, what happens to the thing that the unclean thing touched?
It's going to
be. Yeah. Absolutely. And what does sin ultimately do among people?
Spread.
And what does even death do?
Separation.
Well, but ultimately it spreads. It spreads to the point that even innocent babies who have not committed sin, they die. And so the point is all of this is fundamentally contagious. And so the holy, if something is holy, if something has not sinned, if something is clean, if something lives, if it touches this side, what happens to it? It ultimately is no longer holy. It ultimately becomes sinful. It ultimately is unclean. And all of this at the end, bottom line, is death. Okay? There's one exception to this. And the exception is God himself. Because God certainly is holy. God certainly has no sin. God is clean. God is the epitome of life. What does his name basically mean? Yeah, I am. I exist. I simply am life. There's no adverb, no object or direct object. I am. I am capital L, life, existence, reality, pick whatever word you want. But that's me. And because part of the fundamental meaning of God, now we're using other parts of the Bible, there is no other. No other on the other side from God. God is completely on the other side of the ledger. To what would you liken me or compare me, he asks in Isaiah. There's no metaphor that can completely, convey him to us. No image, no teaching, no rationale. There is no way to fully comprehend God. There is no thing to which he can be compared. He is so thoroughly other. Part of his otherness is unlike any other created thing, because he is uncreated and everything else is created. Part of what, any created thing can ultimately be moved from this side to this side. Any created thing can be moved from this side to this side. But not God. And so what happens when an unclean thing touches God? Does God become unholy? Does God become tainted by sin? Or unclean? Does God die? There it is. Whatever touched God in its uncleanness is destroyed. So thoroughly other is God. That's part of what Leviticus and these laws are meant to convey. So thoroughly other is God that these boundaries are actually for your protection. The boundaries are for your protection. By the way, sit there and say, well, what about the animals? The animals too. Yeah, but remember, what did God say in Genesis 3? Adam and Eve sinned. But as God is handing out consequences, you know, talks to the snake, talks to the woman, talks to the man. Remember, he doesn't actually, contrary to how we often speak of it, he doesn't curse the man. He curses something else.
Right.
And by extension,
creation.
You know, thus Paul in Romans 8, creation was subjected to futility. By the way, so also, Leviticus gets real big real quick. This is a worldview book. This is actually a worldview. If we get bogged down in the parts of the animals and how you stack them on an altar, it's a worldview book. It's about this conveying how God sees reality. And so the animals, you know, this creation is now, in a sense, unclean. You know, because in Leviticus, you can be unclean for non-moral reasons. A woman becomes unclean in childbirth, for instance. You know, sexual activity, even in marriage, makes the man and the woman unclean. You with me? Clean and unclean in and of itself are not moral categories, but all of it's meant to kind of get you in this thought world of what's contagious and what's not. Well, just a second, I'll get you in here. So ultimately, anything can be contaminated. If anything touches the ultimate ground of otherness, of holiness, of separation and difference, which is God Himself, it's destroyed. Quick example of that. What happened to people who touched the Ark of the Covenant? Why? Why would they die if they touched the Ark? What's special about the Ark?
God's presence.
Yeah, because could you touch the lampstand? Yep. Could you touch the altar? Altar of incense?
Yeah.
But if you touch the Ark, because that, unique among the furniture, that was where God dwelt, presence, you know, pick whatever word you want to use to convey the sense that that was the place on earth in which God, sometimes it's called his throne, sometimes it's called his footstool, but the principle is that's where the presence of God on earth, even from, you know, within the tabernacle or the temple, that's where God was. And so by virtue of that, that thing became as holy as God is, and this is that you touch it. And so there famously was one man in the Bible who made the mistake of touching. Remember his name?
Uzzah.
His name was Uzzah. And if you go back and you read the story, by the way, was Uzzah saying, hey, you know, kind of like, you know, silly teenagers at camp, you know, it'd be fun to see what would happen if. No, why did Uzzah touch the Ark anyways? Trying to do a good thing?
Yeah.
Now, granted, you know, part of the whole point in the context of Samuel where that story is told is, who were the last people to move the cart on a cart?
Philistines.
Yeah, and so what does that say about how the Israelites were thinking? Were they following the law or were they thinking like pagans? So, you know, that was first strike. But beyond that, Uzzah was trying to do a decent thing. They're trying to bring the ark back, but he touched it. And so what happened to Uzzah, famously? He died. The place where it happened was given a name in Hebrew, and most English translations still bring a cross. Anybody remember what it was called?
That does.
Do what? Good guess, whoever said that. And we'll play Scott. No. But hey, for effort, I like it. It was called Perez Uzzah. And in Hebrew, Perez means outbreak. To break out. Now, wait a second. I thought Uzzah touched the ark. It's an inbreaking. Why was it called the breaking out against Uzzah? The place of the outbreak, the breaking out against Uzzah. Think about this for a second.
Because it showed everyone else if you did likewise, the same thing would happen to you.
Yeah. But which way?
Out. The power went out from God.
That's what we're looking for. It broke out. You know, Uzzah reaches in the sense. He touches the ark, but that's not what really killed him in a sense. What killed him is the outbreak of the divine against him. In other words, use a modern analogy, the computer firewall. Or actually, well, I say, nah, actually, because that's more complicated. Let's use a firewall in commercial construction. The firewall is designed to protect you by keeping things that need to be kept separate, right? But what happens when the firewall begins to fail? The fire will break out. And what happens to the people against whom the fire breaks out against? In theory, you know, that room burns, that safe room burns, people die. Because ultimately, unlike any created thing which can be moved from holy to unholy, God cannot be so moved. God cannot cross that line by definition, by his very nature. And so what happens instead is our God is a consuming fire. When the unholy touches the holy, that's why it's a fearful thing to fall in the hands of a living God. In the parentheses there, in the Hebrew sense, in a sinful condition, in a rebellious condition. Why? Because our God is a consuming fire. Fire is one of the great metaphors in the Bible, right? Because what fire ultimately does is it destroys the impure and purifies the substantive things. Fire can do either of those things depending on what's put into the fire. And so ultimately, God's holiness will destroy any created thing that touches him in its uncreated, or I'm sorry, in its unpurified state, which means you better figure out how to get purified. Hence the book of Leviticus. And there's even more we can tease out, but that's a big picture intro to what's going on. Does that make sense? And so also you find little hints of that spread throughout the Bible, like in the story of Uzzah. The deep logic of and they understood it. That's why they called it, of all things, Perez Uzzah. God broke out against him. It wasn't that he invaded God. It's that when the unholy Uzzah touches the holy God in actuality, because he touches the ark, and he's merely human, still fallen, he's destroyed. So would an animal who touched Sinai. And that's why you can't touch them. Because now they, in a sense, bear that same destructively divine holiness. And so you shoot them or stone them, but you don't touch them yourself, lest the destructive holiness of God spreads to you in your fallen, unclean, impure state. Make sense? You with me? By the way, other examples of that. Within the logic, I haven't forgotten about you, Adrian, I promise. Just got to get some setup done tonight. Within this logic, this basic world, where death then, in a sense, is both the ultimate result of uncleanness, sin, unholiness, and the actual ultimate unholiness itself, because death is, in a sense, lack of existence. It's you know, yes, I get the whole soul goes to hell, but there's a sense in which you end your existence in a realm. That's part of what it means to die. Yes, I get the whole separation of the body and soul, but when you die, you leave this realm. You don't exist here anymore as such, right? You with me? You will not pass this way again. And just like, God cannot die because life is existence. If God cannot die, he cannot pass out of existence. He is life. Part of what happens then is death, again, is both the consequence of the right side and the ultimate uncleanness itself. So thoroughly so that, for instance, we get into the deeper logic of Leviticus as laws are handed out about clean and unclean and keeping yourself separate in different spheres and in certain occasions from certain things. The high priest. And why the high priest? Because he was the only human being authorized one day a year to go behind the veil into the presence of God, into the most holy place. The one human being who was authorized to enter the unmediated presence of God. And how do we know that? Because he went behind the veil. Use the Hebrew writer's language. Now, the Hebrew writer understood this. That's why the Hebrew talks about going behind the veil. He went behind the veil. What was the veil actually for in the tabernacle, in the temple? It was a boundary. It was a protection to shield you from the presence of God in your false. Even the high priest had to be careful about his condition, because he was the one human being who got to go behind the veil. And we always focus on the blood he took. He took more than blood when he went behind the veil. Remember what else he takes in the other hand?
Hyssop.
Hyssop and the blood's in one hand, but he takes something else in the other hand. You remember what it is? Incense. And what does incense do? What's the point of the incense?
Smoke or clean.
Yeah, and ultimately it creates a cloud. What's the cloud? The veil is the cloud. Well, how does God, if I were back in Exodus 19, how does God come down on Sinai? In a cloud. The cloud wasn't the presence of God. The cloud veiled the presence of God so you were not destroyed. And so what, even then, even though God said, you have permission one day only to come behind this veil into my presence and sprinkle this blood, and even though the blood, we get what the blood represents, even still in his fallen state, what must the high priest still take with him to protect himself? A cloud. A movable veil to protect him from the presence of God. And by the way, did the Jews understand this? Yeah, the Jews understood this. You can read in intertestamental literature where one of the traditions that developed on the Day of Atonement when the high priest went behind the veil was they would actually tie a rope on the high priest before he went in. Why did they do that? Anyone want to take a guess?
Nobody's
going to
go in.
Yeah, nobody's going in for that body. That's exactly right. And so, okay, because you know what the Jews understood? This stuff is deadly serious. We may think it's pedantic and boring. To the ancient Jew, this was life and death. And by the way, true story, how do you know whether the high priest was still alive or not? Just check it. No. See, this is it's actually a test tonight. You know, got to know your high priestly garments. You know what he had on him?
Bells.
Okay. If the bell stops ringing, now you pull the rope. Now you pull the rope and get that guy out of there. Yeah, there were no defibrillators in the tabernacle. It was serious business. Serious business. We've lost our sense of how serious it is to deal with God. This book's going to help us with that. This book is going to do us a lot of spiritual good, I think, if you'll read and plod through, and we'll put some framework in place so that the details, and we won't get bogged down in the details, except when we do like tonight, but we'll pick the key details that give us a framework that I hope will really improve your sense of God. This is a worldview book. This is to help you understand who God is, how he sees reality, how we live before him, because yes, the covenant that undergirds this book is gone. The spiritual reality of this book is very much alive and well in tonight. And the correct approach for Christians to the old law is not, thank God that's gone and we can eat hot dogs now and we don't have to do this. No. The correct response is, all the more now I understand because of Jesus Christ what this book was getting at. How much more then do I need to live the logic and understanding of this book brings us about reality of life before God? That's the correct response. Because the covenant of Christ is not ultimately less responsibility before God. The covenant of Christ is, the end of the times has come upon us. God has revealed everything he's ever going to reveal to the human race. We know things Moses did not know. We know things the Jews did not know. We know things that the high priest who walked behind the veil did not know. How much more, then, are we accountable to God to truly understand what it means to live a holy, clean, pure life before him? Because as the Hebrew writer reminds us, and the Hebrew writer was very much a Levitical thinker. As the Hebrew writer reminds us, the things that this book deals with are actually just the shadows, the copies of the ultimate spiritual reality that you and I now actually deal with under Jesus Christ. We need more fear and trembling in our lives, I think. We need more respect and awe of God. We need more recognition of the fact that the covenant of Christ is not because of grace and mercy and because there aren't as many specifics about what you eat or what you wear or stuff like that. It's not a lesser covenant or a less detailed covenant. It demands all the more thoroughly and deeply a complete allegiance to a holy life before God. And so I hope this book rattles us as well. But part of this book is worldview. It's about seeing the world the way God sees it. And how God sees the world, as this book reveals it, is still in place today. And again, I think it'll be, hopefully it'll be clear by the end of the quarter. Adrian, you have waited for 15 minutes very patiently. Kudos to you, sir. What you got?
I was just going to touch up back on the
sorry.
The animals.
Okay, yeah.
But is that another reason why Jesus is viewed as a lamb? Because the animals were just... they were just an innocent part that just so happened to
get caught in the crossfire.
Yeah, get caught in the crossfire between yeah. humanity and sin.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly I think, you know, again, Paul's language in Romans 8 when he talks about, you know, that creation was subjected to futility, not willingly. You know, because creation didn't do anything wrong. The animals didn't do anything wrong. We, who were meant to have dominion over creation, and because we had dominion, our sin spread, you know, the consequence of our sin spread to what we had dominion over creation. So, yeah, I mean, I think ultimately That's part of it. I think, part of the lamb too is just, and we'll talk about this maybe not tonight, but in weeks down the road, because commentators have wrestled with, we're going to meet a lot of sacrificial animals, all sorts of animals in different situations were to be offered. It wasn't just lambs. If you didn't know that, I've never read Leviticus before. All sorts of animals for different scenarios, different sacrifices. So why, when it comes time to talk about Jesus as the perfect sacrifice, why a lamb? Out of the, you had bulls, goats, birds, grain. We forget that. Spoiler alert. Cain's problem was not that he offered a vegetable offering because God only wants blood. That's not true. Leviticus actually teaches us that God wants grain offerings. It's called the minhah in Hebrew. Leviticus chapter 2, the beginning of the book. And by the way, guess what language Genesis 4 uses of Cain's sacrifice? It was a minhah. That's one of the things, by the way, sidebar. We call these things sacrifices. In Hebrew, when we see this in Leviticus, there's a whole, if you're reading it in Hebrew, a whole technical vocabulary. Every one of these sacrifices has its own Hebrew term. And that helps us a little bit more how these really were categorically different things. The menha is not the hatah, it's not the olah, it's not the awam, it's not the shalom. They all have technical terms. And we just call them all offerings or sacrifices.
First fruits was a grain or a...
Yeah, ironically, that was for the whole feast based upon that, which we then came to call Pentecost in the New Testament. But back to lamb is innocent. Part of it is the lamb is young and vulnerable. Lambs don't fight back like a bull could. And of course, Isaiah picks up on that when in describing the willing sacrifice of Jesus. Like a sheep before it shears is dumb. The sheep is one of the more passive animals. If you went to the rodeo this year, think about trying to get one of those bulls. We just read this stuff and take it casually, man. This was a five-sense system. It was physical. It was tactile. You had to touch and wrangle these animals. You could hear it. You ever heard an animal scream when you kill it? The smell of burning flesh. This isn't barbecue. You're not just cooking the good stuff. You put all of that bull up on that altar and you start burning it. Burning flesh.
And hair.
And hair. Yeah, it's not pretty. And it's messy. You ever seen we don't have butchers in our grocery store anymore. Some of us are old enough to remember. Remember they still had the butcher in the grocery store? Mm-hmm. And what did that guy look like at 4 o'clock in the afternoon?
Yes.
And by the way, and that's with meat. That's already been bled before it came over to the grocery store. What were those priest's garments? Well, what did a priest look like at the end of a day in the temple? You ever thought about that? And all of it to undergird.
And the smell.
And the smell. And the noise.
You fly down Amarillo, right? That's a tiny...
All right. Well, real quick, because we never get as far as I hope, but because we were still in the first place, I want to look at Nexus tonight. Real quick, then let's push on. Though we actually covered a lot of what I did want to get to tonight. So basically, if anything touches the mountain, as you prepare yourself, as you make yourself holy, clean, pure, you don't touch it, you shoot it or stone it. And when the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain, so most of them down from the mountain to the people, consecrated the people, they washed their garments, they said to the people, be ready for the third day, do not go near a woman. Why? Because in Leviticus we learn that even legitimate sexual activity makes you unclean. We'll talk about why. There is a method to the madness of what makes for clean and unclean as it goes on. If it seems random as you've read Leviticus in the past, why these things make you unclean, things that aren't immoral, but they still make you unclean. God said, be fruitful and multiply, and yet a woman's unclean for giving birth? What's that about? God said, be fruitful and multiply, and the husband and wife, if you do this too close to a feast day, you miss out because together you have both become unclean for the marital act. What is that? There's a logic to it, and again, we'll explore that as we go further. But there is a way to make sense of all this. But because we know from Leviticus that sexual activity, legitimate sexual activity, makes you unclean even. Don't touch a woman. On the third day, thunders and lightnings, a thick cloud on the mountain, a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God. One of the most amazing statements in all the Bible, in my mind. And they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. Now, Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord had descended on it in fire, which is a great representation of that destructive holiness. destructive, the unclean, impure thing. Just like impure things get burned up in a fire, whereas gold gets stronger. You with me? That's part of why it's an apt metaphor for God. Fire works for God on a lot of levels, but one of which is if you're not worthy, if you can't stand the fire, it destroys you. God comes down. And the smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. And Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. And the Lord came down on Mount Sinai, the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. All right, stop right there real quick. One of the things that we're going to learn about temple and tabernacle, there are three areas to Mount Sinai, if you watch the language carefully. There's the top of the mountain. That's where God actually is, and only Moses gets to go up there. Then there's the mountain itself, and then there's around the mountain. And the people can come around the mountain or up to the mountain. Believe it or not, others are allowed on the mountain, but not to the top of the mountain. Exodus chapter 24. God tells Moses to bring Aaron and 70 elders on there. So let's put the 70 for sake of time. And so what you actually have is three categories of places in the Sinai event. You have what we would later call in the tabernacle and the temple, the courtyard, where anybody could come to the altar and offer their sacrifice. You have the holy place, where only the select can go. Instead of the 70 elders, it becomes the priests. And then you have the most holy place, the top of the mountain, the most holy place, where God actually is, behind the veil in the cloud, and only one man gets to go there. Moses at Sinai, and eventually once the tabernacle and temple are in place and up and running, the high priest. Because the temple and tabernacle were a version of Sinai. God is setting a pattern in place of approachability. Barriers not to be crossed depending on who you are. Unless God calls you, and that's an important verb here, unless God calls you. We'll see that again in just a second. And again, basically, ascending levels of holiness. The intensity of the holiness gets higher and therefore more dangerous. You with me? Make sense? See that? Okay. So, the key verse here before we leave, 19, is this. That's good enough. One last thing, though. Verse 23. Again, the people cannot come up to Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, set limits around the mountain and consecrate it. Yep, that's all about boundaries. That's holiness in a nutshell. Chapter 24, though, real quick. Chapter 24, verse 16. Actually, verse 15. Let's start reading there. Moses went up on the mountain. This is after the giving of the Ten Commandments, the ten big ideas, and the people have accepted the covenant, and the covenant's been ratified. Some blood's been splashed around. So the covenant has been enacted, and there's the celebratory meal. We call it the Lord's Supper today, that kind of commemorates the making of the covenant. This was their version of it. But verse 15, then Moses went up on the mountain, the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, God called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. And so you have two key verbs there. You have, I'll switch colors here, because I'm making a mess. You have two key verbs there in 16. You have the cloud covered, protect from God's presence, and you have God called. Why can Moses go up? Because God
called.
All right. And so we have the Sinai thing go down, but then they're not supposed to stay at Sinai forever. God's got the promise to keep to get them into the land where they're going to dwell together. I will be their God, they will be my people, I will dwell among them. We've got to get there. So we're going to build a tabernacle, a portable Sinai. We're going to build a tabernacle, and eventually, Deuteronomy, I'll place my name somewhere, and we'll build a temple, a permanent version of the tabernacle. Get to the end of chapter 40 in Exodus, and we see this as we transition into Leviticus. Let's see. Verse 33. And Moses erected the court around the tabernacle and the altar, set up the screen of the gate of the court, and so Moses finished the work. It's all built and set up exactly according to the pattern God showed Moses on the mountain. God says, basically, on the mountain, here's my Sinai script. Come down and build me a structure that's going to work for this. And so, having built it and set it up and finished, verse 34, the cloud covered the tent of meeting. Oh, there's that verb again. Now the cloud is not covering Sinai, the cloud is covering the tent of meeting. The cloud covered the tent of meeting. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses was not able to enter the tent of meeting because the cloud settled on him. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. God's presence was there. And even Moses, because of the extreme holiness and glory, even Moses could no longer be in that structure that he helped build and set up. Even Moses was driven away by the holiness and the glory of God. And so throughout all their journeys, whenever the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, people of Israel would set out. But if the cloud was not taken up, they did not set out till the day that the cloud was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was on the tabernacle by day, fire was in it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. Leviticus chapter 1, verse 1, and the Lord called. Oh, there's the other verb. Now we finish the pattern. And the Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting. Not from Sinai anymore, but from where now? Why the tent of meeting? Because that's where he's moved. He's left the mountain and he's come down to, because we're going to go on this journey. That's what the Indexes was saying. And this is how I bring the Sinai concept. Barriers, holiness, separation, but I want to be with you. And we're putting in place a way for me to dwell among you according to this pattern. And then not die, and I can still be with you. And so we have the covered and the called. And so Leviticus is the called part, where God now lays out to Moses what we're going to do. Because what's happening is, as we go through the Pentateuch, first you needed the place. Then you needed the procedures, which is what Leviticus is going to be. The first seven chapters of Leviticus are going to be about the sacrificial system, the procedures, the blood and the burning that's going to allow unholy people, unclean people, to be there and allow a holy God to stay in the midst of them without destroying them. Because one of the things that we forget is the sacrifices just weren't for the sins of the people. On the Day of Atonement, one of the sacrifices' blood was sprinkled on the tabernacle itself. Why? Because your sin is contagious, and so God's getting tired of his tent getting stunk up by your sin. And so the place itself needed to be purified. And so procedures, and then lastly, you need people to do it. And that's Leviticus 8 through 10, where we have the consecration of the priesthood. And they're put into action, and they have their first hiccup with Nadab and Abihu in chapter 10. Fascinating story. So you have place, procedures, and people. And that's what's going on here. And so we now have a new place covered up, and God calling once again to Moses and saying, here's what we need to do for this new place with some people and get a different kind of operation going on. Does that make sense? Okay. All right, and I've got 3 minutes left. What's on my list? Let's do this. Let's talk a little bit more about holiness, clean and unclean, conceptually. And that'll probably be the last couple of minutes. Leviticus, going back to the beginning, Genesis 1 and 2. A time when God always said after everything he did, it was good. Part of what made it good was God was taking what was formless and void, remember Genesis 1 and 2, and he was bringing structure to it. And a lot of that structure was actually boundary making. He divided the light from the dark. He divided the sea from the firmament. Water from firmament, then sea from distinction from land, right? You with me? He was dividing. He was setting up boundaries. That's holiness. Part of what makes holy a creation or a world holy is when God sets the lines and the boundaries where he wants them. What ruins a creation, makes something unholy or unclean, is when people transgress the boundaries that God sets up and calls good. And so part of what Leviticus is actually doing is saying part of how humanity and God are going to get back together is literally, you got to go back to learning to live with the lines as I set them. That's part of how we're going to live together again. It's another creation. It's the basic beginning of another recreation. The new heavens and new earth haven't come yet. But God is being in training wheel form till the Israelites. Basically, how we get back to what we're supposed to be is you got to live in a world as I created it. Rather than Genesis 3, you break those boundaries. God says, don't eat of that tree, and so you eat of that tree. God says, have the meaning of the animals, instead you're listening to the animals. God says, the husband is the head of the wife. And Adam, God says to Adam, because you listen to the voice of your wife. all sorts of boundaries that God had established in Genesis 3 broke down. That's called sin. And so part of what Leviticus is saying is we're going to start a new another creation in a sense. I'm going to go back, I'm going to draw some law and boundaries and lines. I'm going to make some separations. I don't care whether they make sense to you or not. You can hear about sin. The point is, if I say don't eat of that tree, then? And if I say don't eat of that unclean animal, don't eat of it. And if I say, you know, basically don't have sex, married people, right before a holy day, then? Whether it makes sense to you or not, you live within the lines as I create them. That's holiness. Make sense? Brian, you wanted to tell this.
Order of chaos.
Yes, 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 that's exactly right. God brings order. Chaos is the result when we break God's boundaries. Just like, you know, when you've got a bunch of boxes in your garage and one of those boxes gets old, what happens when that box gets old and breaks? And you have, and it's called chaos. Otherwise known as a garage sale. All right. Thanks for being here tonight. And until next time.